This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, please see the MCLE website.
Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about today are the clinical and legal standards for the determination of capacity in guardianship and conservatorship. And as you'll see, at times those are two separate issues, clinical and legal, but often the two overlap. So in making a capacity, doing a capacity assessment, some of the early questions that we want to be addressing, and this is particularly with reference to medical decision making, is does the person themselves express a preference? So do they have a preference for a type of treatment that they would like to receive or don't want to receive? Do they have a history of making medical decisions already that may have been appropriate? Do they have certain individuals that they tend to rely upon to help them make decisions? So trying to get a better sense of who they are and what their history in some ways of making decisions has been. Then the next question, do they understand the facts? So if they are to be undergoing some type of surgery, for example, do they understand the risks of that? Do they understand what some of the issues are in terms of a medical decision? And can they appreciate how these facts might apply to them, both including the risks and benefits of either having a treatment or not having a treatment? So you might have an individual who it's been recommended that they have a heart surgery, but they may not accept that they have a heart condition or that this surgery is necessary. So do they really have an understanding of what is going on in their life in order to be able to, and what is going on with their body in order to make a decision to have a treatment or not have a treatment, to accept a surgery or to refuse this surgery, to accept assistance with taking medication to manage diabetes or to refuse that because they think that they can manage their diabetes independently? So do they really have an appropriate understanding of what's going on in both their life and with them medically? And then are they able to manipulate information in coming to a decision? And again, this is consistent who they are as a person. So in terms of capacity, perhaps the question is whether or not they are able to continue to live independently. And they may think that they are managing perfectly fine and that there aren't any issues, but an outsider coming in, the way that my practice works is that I frequently make a home visit, and so I can see the conditions that they might be living in. But are they saying that they're eating fine, they're taking their medications, their house is clean, but coming in, I can see that there's no food in the refrigerator and that their medications are empty. So are they able to make a decision based on what is actually going on in their life? Can they understand that if they accept help, that they might be able to get groceries, or if they allow nurses to come in, that their medical conditions are going to be managed better? Can they envision an alternative of living independently with assistance and what that might look like? Or are they completely refusing to accept any assistance because they think that they are managing fine when it's obvious that they're not? And then also, can the person provide a consistent response to their preferences? So this sometimes comes into play if they're making a decision, for example, about end-of-life decisions. And at times they might say that they want to have extreme measures, but then the next time they're asked, and sometimes that might be dependent upon who's in the room, they might make a different, give a different response to that. Or so are they consistently saying giving the same message? Are they telling me consistently that they want their daughter who lives locally to be their healthcare proxy? Or does that change depending upon, did they recently visit with their son? And does that person now say that they want that person to be their healthcare proxy? So we're looking for a consistent message and stating a consistent preference. So when we are making a determination about capacity, and this relates to both guardianship and conservatorship, and these questions apply to the completion of the medical certificate, which I'll talk about a little bit more shortly, but when you are filing for guardianship or conservatorship, you need to have a medical certificate completed by either a physician, a clinical psychologist, or a nurse practitioner. So there's three different components that come into play when making a determination about capacity. And the first is, and this is one of the first questions on the medical certificate, is what is the diagnosis that is interfering with an individual's capacity? And so it has to be a clinically diagnosed condition. It can't just be someone says, oh, they're bipolar, they've always been bipolar. Without a medical professional making a diagnosis, then you really can't move forward with completing a medical certificate and making a determination about capacity. And that's true for both a guardianship and a conservatorship, that you need a clinically diagnosed condition. So this could be major depression, it could be bipolar disorder, it could be schizophrenia, it could be any type of dementia, amongst other things. So then this clinical diagnosis then must result in a decision-making problem. And on the medical certificate, it is listed as an inability to receive and evaluate information or make or communicate decisions. So in some way, if they have a dementia diagnosis, are their memory impairments interfering with their ability to hold on to information in order to be able to use that information to make a decision? If they are, if they have a diagnosis of schizophrenia, are they experiencing delusions or paranoia that might make it so that they're not able to accurately either trustworthy individuals around them or use information presented to them and evaluate that in a way that they can then use that information to make a decision? And that's true for both a guardianship or conservatorship in terms of the decision-making problem. In terms of the conservatorship, are they able to track where they have their money, and are they able to appropriately determine that they're paying their bills, or to recall who they might have, which child, if they're picking a particular child to leave an aspect of their estate to, are they able to recall that decision and kind of explain the reasons for that decision? And then with the decision-making problem, that also then needs to result in a functional problem. So it's not just that they are having trouble making the decision, that needs to be impacting their functioning in some way. So in terms of guardianship, that would mean that they can no longer meet essential requirements for physical health, safety, and self-care. So it would be things like, are they able to prepare food and remember to eat? Is the place that they're living appropriate? Is it clean? Are they able to maintain their hygiene appropriately? Can they remember to take their medications? Are they able to find a place, an appropriate setting for them to live in? If they have difficulties managing stairs, it's not really appropriate for them to be choosing a third floor walk-up apartment if it's a place that they're not going to be able to get in and out of. And similarly, in terms of the conservatorship, the functional problem would mean that they can no longer manage their business or property or financial affairs independently, and that they are at risk for either losing their money or mismanaging their money without appropriate assistance. So are they involved in a financial scam, and are they subsequently racking up credit card debt because they are trying to get money to meet whatever the criteria of the financial scam is? Or are they continuing to give money to a family member who comes to them constantly for money, and they're giving them money, and then they subsequently don't have any money for themselves to pay their own bills or buy their groceries? So how do we determine whether or not an individual has a diagnosis that would negatively impact their decision-making? So again, some of the questions that we're asking in terms of a capacity determination are, have they expressed a preference regarding who they might want to help them make decisions, regarding specific decisions that they may be making? Do they understand the facts presented to them? Can they appreciate the risks and benefits of a decision in either way? Can they appreciate the risks of making a particular decision or not making a particular decision? The risk of staying in at home without any assistance, or the benefits of moving to a more appropriate setting. The risk of selling your house to your child for a small amount of money without having a place for you to live yourself, or the benefit of not making that decision and continuing to live in the home that you have paid for. And are they thinking rationally? So then the next question becomes, why, if they do in fact lack capacity, why is that? And is it related to a neurological or psychiatric status? Are they extremely depressed? Are they experiencing a psychosis? Are they experiencing a delirium related to a medical issue? And often, in terms of the type of assessments that I do, that we're also looking at, do they have some type of dementia or other cognitive disorder? And that's frequently then diagnosed through a neuropsychological evaluation. And then the other question is this condition reversible? So is their decision making impaired because they have a delirium? And a delirium often happens after a surgery or as a result of an infection. The person may be extremely confused, but once whatever medical issue they're experiencing has resolved, then they may be able to go back to functioning and making decisions as they had done previously. Or if they are self-neglecting because of the severe depression, once the depression has resolved, they then may be able to go back to functioning as they had previously. One of the important factors, as mentioned previously, is how are these medical conditions or psychiatric conditions impacting their functioning. And this is where often when we talk later about contested guardianships or contested conservatorships, you may often find yourself in a situation where you have two different professionals evaluating the same person and coming up with very different conclusions, and how can that be? So often, and often that relates to the type of evaluation that has been done and the information that is available to the individual doing the assessment. But oftentimes a person who has some type of impairment, particularly if we're talking about a dementia, they may have a number of retained abilities. So their memory may actually continue to be intact in some ways, or they may be able to recall specifics of whatever the issue that they are dealing with at that point, even though they may also be forgetting to take their medication or forgetting to pay bills. And so it's often, if you have a memory impairment, it doesn't necessarily encompass every area of your functioning. An individual may also have very good social skills. So if you have someone that's always been very verbal and able to, is used to talking to people and can kind of talk a good game about whatever it is that the issue is, they can often mask what is actually going on, mask their degree of impairment. You know, sometimes an individual can talk a lot sort of superficially about different things, and depending upon the length of the assessment, you may not notice if you're maybe only with them for 10 or 15 minutes that they tend to repeat themselves and will eventually tell you the same story again. Or if you ask them a question, they may speak a lot or talk around the issue without actually ever providing you with the answer to the question that you're looking for. But because their social skills and their speech is kind of fluent and they're talking a lot, it may seem like they know very well what they're talking about. So if memory seems to be intact, it's also really important to also address their executive functioning. And memory and executive functioning are typically the two most important areas if there's impairment there that are going to affect a person's ability to make decisions. So executive functioning is planning, organization, reasoning, problem solving, if you have an impairment in executive functioning, that's the kind of impairment, sometimes even more so than memory, that is going to make you susceptible to fall for a financial scam. To, you know, one of the frequent scams that we see is that you get a call that you've won a lottery, but that you have to pay the taxes first, so that you have to pay $20,000, but then you're going to get $5 million. And so if your executive functioning is intact, you can kind of reason through, well, that doesn't really make sense. That's not how lotteries or sweepstakes work. But if you have even a small impairment in your reasoning, sometimes it can be enough that you're really not able to process that, and that makes you then vulnerable to repeated scams and losing significant amounts of money. So looking at executive functioning, really one of the main ways that we look at that is through a formal assessment. There's some basic bedside techniques, so that that in the hospital, a psychiatrist or physician or psychologist is able to utilize. Often with these bedside techniques, these are things like the mini mental state exam or the MoCA. They are good at picking up if there's impairment, but sometimes if there's significant impairment, but sometimes because these screening tests are pretty easy, it can be a person might perform quite well on the MoCA, for example, but actually have much more significant impairment that would really only be evident if you did a more formal assessment. So the neuropsychological evaluation, particularly when we're talking about areas related to any type of dementia, but also some psychiatric issues such as schizophrenia or even major depression, there's a difference between the level of sensitivity that you're going to be able to capture with the two different evaluations. So with the MoCA, typically you have to learn 5 words, but with a that's the test of memory. In a neuropsychological evaluation, you might have a list of 10 to 20 words that you have to learn. In addition to that, you're read stories, you're shown pictures and have to try to recall what was going on in the picture. You have to copy a drawing and then remember the drawing. So it's looking at memory in a variety of ways, because sometimes a person might do quite well in one aspect of memory but have more significant impairment on a different type of memory. On the MoCA, the executive functions are measured with the clock and then 2 reasoning questions. But again, in a more formal assessment, you're going to be doing a much more in-depth, take a much more in-depth look at their executive functioning. The clock drawing is a simple test, but if an individual doesn't do well on it, it's telling. And basically in the clock drawing, you ask the individual to draw a clock, put the numbers in, and then set the time on the clock to 10 after 11. So you can get a lot of information with that test. Can they draw the clock? Can they put the numbers in appropriately? Can they set the time to 10 after 11? A lot of times people will put the hands on the numbers 10 and 11, or write 10 and 11 on the clock, or circle the numbers 10. They might circle the 11 and the 2, which is kind of on the right track, but not quite there. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't tell time, because if I show them a clock that shows 10 after 11, they can typically tell me that time. But that little test does give you a lot of information. And then we also look at attention. So on the MoCA, you have to be able to repeat 5 digits forward and 4 digits backwards. That's the limit there. It's a much more involved test in the neuropsychological evaluation. Orientation, so are you oriented to time, place, person? Those are pretty similar across the two. A language measure, you know, again, the MoCA sort of touches on a little bit of what happens in a neuropsychological evaluation. One of the tests that we give is that you have to come up with all the words that you can think of to specific letters of the alphabet. So on the MoCA, it's just an F, but in a neuropsych eval, it's 3 letters plus as many animals and grocery items. That's a test that really shows you both their language ability, but in addition to that, something that we call initiation. And so that's kind of the ability to think about doing something and following through and doing that. That can give a lot of information about a person's ability to carry out a decision that they might have made. And so if you're looking at an issue of undue influence and someone seems to be making all these decisions and changes that are supposedly they're making for themselves, but if they actually have difficulties with initiation, it's kind of difficult to pair those two, that they probably wouldn't necessarily be able to do that, and that can often give some insight into the fact that someone else might be pushing them to make those decisions. And then visual spatial relationships, again, it's fairly simple on the MoCA, and then on a neuropsychological evaluation, it just kind of takes it to another level and you get much more in-depth information. So when we're thinking about capacity or incapacity, there's a lot of different factors that we're weighing, and we're trying to incorporate both their level of cognitive functioning, psychiatric functioning, and to see how they're doing functionally in order to determine both things that they're able to continue to do well, are there areas of weakness, things that they're having trouble with, but also areas of strength. So are there some decisions that they're going to still be able to make? And one of the factors to consider also is that sometimes a person might function quite poorly on a cognitive evaluation, but actually be functioning and legitimately functioning well at a much higher level than their testing would indicate. That could be an indication that, perhaps these were areas that they never functioned well in, so they never would have tested well, and so you're giving them a test now, but they're really not doing any differently at 80 than they would have done at 40. So it's also really important to look at their history. And then you also want to get a good sense of what is causing this diagnosis. So if they are depressed, have they been depressed throughout their lives, and this is kind of the natural ebb and flow of depression for them? Have they never been depressed before, and this is a new onset of depression? And that can give some sense of their likelihood of improving. And is this diagnosis temporary or permanent? So are they confused right now because of an infection? Do they have a condition such as hydrocephalus, which is a condition where there's fluid on the brain, but if that's resolved, then they may be able to go back to functioning as they had previously. So it's really important to understand both the diagnosis and then how might we expect this diagnosis to progress. So some of the conditions, again, that might improve with treatment are psychosis and mood disorders, and again, that depends on the individual. An individual with a long history of schizophrenia, and that is primarily presents as delusions or psychosis and paranoia, if they've had that throughout their life, then it's sort of their condition might improve slightly, but it's unlikely that they are going to return to a situation where they can really make continuously appropriate decisions for themselves. A delirium may improve, but oftentimes, particularly if there's a repeat of delirium, sometimes that is the indication that you may be having the beginnings of dementia, and that often becomes evident if they've had several deliriums. Also, sometimes a person will have delirium after a surgery, so if you've had anesthesia, it can frequently take 6 to 9 months, particularly in someone that's somewhat vulnerable, for them to really be able to return to functioning as they had prior to the surgery. So a follow-up, getting a baseline sometime after the surgery, but then also having a follow-up, in many cases, an individual will actually be functioning much better 6 or 9 months later. And then is their decision-making impaired because of substance use? Are they actively drinking, but if they're in a setting where they are now sober, they may be able to make much better decisions for themselves. So there are certain conditions that aren't going to improve. Dementia, there's no treatment for it. So once you're diagnosed with dementia, the course may be different for everyone, but that is a condition that's going to get worse over time. And then some people have conditions that relapse and remit. So some types of MS, for example, sometimes an individual might be more confused, but then at other times their cognition is actually quite clear. When you are asked to see someone again for a subsequent evaluation, there's a number of important factors to consider. Sometimes a person will look better because they're in a place. because they're in a placement. So they were living independently. They weren't getting their medication. They didn't have socialization. They weren't eating well. And now they're in an assisted living or skilled nursing setting, and they look great. But do they look great because they are better and that they can go back to living independently again? Or are they looking great because they need that level of structure to enable them to continue to look great? And those can sometimes be tricky evaluations. You know, sometimes you kind of need to allow someone to fail again. So to say, okay, you know, you can make this decision to return home. And then when they get home and you see that the same pattern has happened again, it becomes clear that they really do need a long-term placement. Similarly, an individual who experiences a mental illness, if they're getting the structure and the medication that they might be receiving, they're going to look much better in a setting. Or if they have to let services in, if they have to allow nurses in to give them their medication. So a subsequent evaluation, sometimes even if someone is looking great at a facility, and their memory impairment may not be evident in conversation before a decision is made that they can perhaps make their own decisions again, it is really important to have a subsequent thorough evaluation. I've had a number of cases where I've done an assessment and the person is clearly impaired, but then they go and they're somewhere else. They're in a hospital. You know, maybe I've invoked the healthcare proxy and they're in a hospital setting, and suddenly, because they look good and it's someone doing a quick bedside assessment, the determination is made that they can change their healthcare proxy or the healthcare proxy should be uninvoked. But you're really not comparing the same things there. The reasons that the healthcare proxy were invoked still remain, even though they might happen to look good at that time when they're in the hospital. So it's really important that when those decisions are made to make a change in decision making, that a thorough evaluation is done again.
Excuse me, Liz.
Yep.
When you
Jim, you're muted.
When you mentioned the subsequent evaluations, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Do you give the same panoply of tests, or do you change the test because of familiarity with the test?
I typically give the same test again. I mean, particularly in a dementia diagnosis, you know, if it's rare that I would evaluate someone a week later. So for the most part, every once in a while, I'll have someone that I see them a year later and they kind of remember a bit of the test. But once there's impairment there, it's rare that then I give the evaluation again and the person does better because they remembered some part of it. It's kind of enough that they're doing in the evaluation that there wouldn't really be an ability to kind of carry that over and then use that information to do better the next time.
In the clock drawing test,
yes.
My daughters would have difficulty reading an old-fashioned clock.
Yes.
I imagine that's going to come up more and more. Is there a substitute for it?
I mean, you know, there are some simple kind of verbal tests that we can give. But yeah, I mean, that's a good question. We are going to have to change when this current generation starts developing dementia to come up with something else. I mean, right now, my patient population in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, it hasn't been an issue yet, but I think it is. It's a great question. Another way that we look at executive functioning is asking things like, how are apples and bananas the same? They're both fruit. And the questions get more complicated, like how are a shoulder and an ankle the same? So looking at verbal reasoning, and then there's some visual reasoning that can be fairly simple. Like you're shown three pictures and it's two triangles and a circle, which two are the same, but then it gets more complicated, like a square, two squiggles, two triangles, which two are the same, and it's the squiggles and the triangles because there's two of them. So there's ways to look at executive functioning. But the clock drawing is great because it's so simple, but yeah, it will be a problem going forward. It just hasn't been a problem yet. So the medical certificate, you know, I touched on that at the beginning, and the questions that we're asking get back to that. What's the diagnosis? How is it impacting their decision-making, and what impact is it having on their functional ability? So what are their physical and mental limitations, and how are these limitations affecting them functionally. It's really important in the medical certificate. I'm sure the attorneys on the panel here and many of you in the audience have seen a really bad medical certificate where, you know, there's kind of a diagnosis and then there's very little direction about what types of decisions can be made and can't be made. The goal is really always to have to try to retain as much decision making as possible for the individual. So, you know, some of the questions on in terms of guardianship that are asked, that I'm asked to make a decision about, are, you know, usually fairly straightforward, like, can they maintain relationships? Can they use the telephone? Can they structure some of their leisure time? Can they be left alone without danger? And then some get more complicated, like, can they make medical decisions? Can they manage their medications? Can they identify abuse or neglect? So it gets more complicated. Can they drive? That's always a challenging one. So a good medical certificate will really give a very specific breakdown of areas that they can make decisions and areas that they can't. It's rare that I would write a medical certificate where I would say that they can't make any decisions either for guardianship or conservatorship for themselves. We try to retain some sense of independence if that's appropriate. So if you're not, in terms of capacity, sometimes you're also making a decision about determining can they name a healthcare proxy or power of attorney, and whether or not that should be invoked. So the healthcare proxy, unlike a guardianship or conservatorship, a person can just change that. It has to be signed and all that, but the determination for whether or not someone can name a healthcare proxy is certainly lower than whether or not they require a guardian. And oftentimes, in terms of naming a healthcare proxy or invoking the healthcare proxy, it's different and also can be a lower threshold than trying to appoint a guardian or, for the power of attorney, appoint a conservator. Although, if you have an appropriate healthcare proxy and have an appropriate power of attorney or durable power of attorney, oftentimes you can avoid needing to have a guardian or a conservator. You know, we run into problems, of course, if whoever it is that is the healthcare proxy is inappropriate and is either not doing what they need to do if the healthcare proxy has been invoked, or if they are exploiting the individual in some way. So I do have a couple of case examples, but I think I can save those for later. Maybe we can talk through some of that, because I think my time is up.
Liz, thank you very much.
Sure.
And yes, hopefully we can get those later, maybe this afternoon, some of the case studies, which are really helpful. We do have one question. It's really, I guess, about the legal structure for protective proceedings in Massachusetts. The question: I'm in Connecticut, and we have conservators for adults and guardians for minors and intellectually disabled persons. Is this the same in Massachusetts? Does anybody want to take a shot at a response?
Can you read that again, John?
Yes. In Connecticut, they have conservators for adults and guardians for minors and intellectually disabled persons. Is this the same in Massachusetts? So I think the response would be kind of like a summary of how Massachusetts deals with both the conservator and guardianship aspect of a minor, somebody who's suffering mental illness, and somebody who is intellectually incapacitated.
Yeah, we call a person an adult under conservatorship a protected person rather than an incapacitated person. Person under guardianship is called an incapacitated person. A minor, when you file a conservatorship for a minor or a guardian, you don't need a medical certificate. They're automatically incompetent simply because of their age. With an adult, either a guardian or a conservator. Often you have one person, you have a guardian and a conservator over the same person. Usually that's the same person, but sometimes you may have different fiduciaries, a different guardian from the conservator. So I don't know if that answered the question or not.
I think so. I think generally speaking, we have both guardians and conservators for adults and guardians and conservators for minors. As Jim said, the minority is considered a basis by itself for appointment of either a guardian, which is of the person dealing with personal and medical issues, and or conservator dealing with the financial and property issues. And for adults, that can be based on incapacity, which is based on mental illness, or incapacity based on intellectual incapacity. And I think that is the only question on this. Thank you, Dr. Nasser.
My pleasure.
That was really helpful.
Thank you.